focus of my contribution is to explore the impact which the use of intelligence as evidence, or the desire to use intelligence as evidence, has on the design of formal legal adjudicative mechanisms for authorising responses of particular kinds to terrorism. Now, what do I mean by formal legal adjudicative mechanisms? It seems to me that there are two types of mechanisms or responses which might be encompassed by that. The first is the paradigmatic criminal justice response, where the individual is charged with an offence, prosecuted, perhaps even acquitted, not necessarily convicted, and punished and put away. Intelligence as part of that process is generally said by officialdom not to be very useful for a range of reasons, some of which has to do with the nature of intelligence, which I will talk about later, but or what I conceive it to be anyway. It's unlikely to help reach the standard of proof required in a criminal trial, which essentially is a degree of certainty beyond reasonable doubt that the individual committed the acts concerned. And secondly, whatever about the other kinds of processes that I'm going to look at in the context of a criminal trial, there is very limited opportunity for one side to keep evidence secret and to use it in a secret way in order to influence the decision maker to arrive at a particular decision. Because, therefore, that intelligence evidence would have to be made available in open court, it would have to be tested, its provenance would have to be examined, and so on. This raises policy concerns about making secret national security type information or the methods by which it is garnered available to the public and to alleged terrorists and other persons who are involved in terrorism. But the second body of mechanisms for taking formal decisions as part of the process of authorising legal response to terrorism is comprised of a series of more or less executive actions which I've attempted to set out on the handout in the form of a chart. The most common and best known one at the moment are control orders, which are imposed pursuant to the Prevention of Terrorism Act 2000, the power set out in the Prevention of Terrorism Act 2005. Control orders are legal orders which impose conditions upon individuals. The normal condition would be there's a cocktail of conditions to which individuals are made subject. Most of them are made subject to a curfew. The exact length of time that a curfew can be imposed on the individual has been a matter of legal debate, but in most of the initial cases it was an 18-hour curfew where the individual was required to live in and stay in a particular residence. The vast majority of people, all but one of the people who have been subject to a control order, were required to move from their original homes to a residence which the Home Office fixed up for them. They were, and they are subject to conditions about who can visit them in their home, and anybody who wants to visit them has to be authorised, and electronic tagging, and prohibitions on meeting people in the time that they're allowed out, in the non-curfew time, specified places of religious worship, and so on and so forth. A long list of conditions are imposed via the control order system. So that's one alternative to the criminal justice model. Another, of course, would be to deport an individual if the individual is not a British citizen. There are powers to do that under the Immigration Act, under the Immigration Act 1971, and as I've indicated here on the handout, the person can be deported where the Home Secretary deems their presence in the United Kingdom not to be conducive to the public good for reasons of national security. Another response which doesn't fit into the paradigmatic criminal prosecution mode is to freeze the assets of a person who may be suspected of being involved in terrorism, for instance. Ordinarily, the freezing of assets will only follow a conviction in relation to the property in question. However, there are special powers relating to the freezing of the assets of an individual who is suspected of being associated with Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, or the Taliban. Although these come from the United Nations Security Council rather than domestic law originally. Another response would be prescription, that is to declare that an organisation or group of people are involved in terrorism and therefore to ban them. That is different to the other responses which I referred to because that focuses on organisations and the structure and networks, if you like, as distinct from individuals. So, in any event, what I'm going to look at is the way in which intelligence is used as evidence in these kinds of adjudicative or decision-making processes. The distinction between the most of these decision-making processes and a decision about whether or not somebody has committed a criminal offence in the ordinary way is that the object of the exercise in a criminal trial is to determine whether or not the individual committed, putting it in brief terms, acts which constitute the constituents of a criminal offence. The object of the exercise is therefore not to decide whether or not this individual is a risk. Rather, it is to look at whether or not, on evidence, it can be determined beyond reasonable doubt whether or not an individual has done whatever thing is prohibited. These other measures, however, have as their objective and have as their justification, the argument is, taking action because the individual presents a risk, as distinct from saying we can prove beyond reasonable doubt that this particular individual has done something which is prohibited. So what I'm looking at is the use of intelligence as evidence within that context. It seems to me, looking at what is evidence, that evidence is information which is relevant to proving or establishing that some matter was, is, or will be the case. So evidence is merely information which is relevant to proving or establishing whatever it is declared has to be proved or established. Now, intelligence is, of course, information. And it seems to me that there's a confusion between the sometimes between whether or not the information is collected by an intelligence agency and whether or not what is collected is intelligence, which in some way is distinguishable from evidence. Intelligence is capable of being evidence if it is relevant to the thing which has to be proven or established. There will, of course, be questions about how the intelligence was collected. And that is a question which I'm not going to go into today. But assuming it is collected in accordance with the relevant law, there's no a priori reason why intelligence cannot be evidence in the sense of being relevant to the thing which has to be proven. In fact, intercept evidence is a classic example of that. There's no particular special thing about intercept evidence. It is real evidence. It could be very important that somebody had a conversation saying that it was their intention to plant a bomb. That may be very relevant evidence to a charge of conspiracy to cause explosions. It may not on its own be the only evidence which you need, but it would be relevant evidence. However, there are probably other sorts of intelligence if you like. And Bill said earlier that intelligence was information and the interpretation of information. And Professor Clive Walker has said that intelligence is information with value-added analysis. However, intelligence seldom presents the full story, according to Lord Butler's report into the review of intelligence on the weapons of mass destruction, which never were, apparently. He said intelligence is often sporadic and patchy, and even after analysis, may still be inferential. In other words, it requires one to draw inferences from the intelligence in an analytical or interpretive fashion. Obviously, this presents a problem if evidence is to be used, if intelligence is to be used as evidence for arriving at particular judgments. And what I want to look at is the various techniques or ways in which formal adjudicative mechanisms such as control orders and the decision making about that get around those problems, if you like, in order to allow intelligence to be used as evidence. And the first technique, intelligence can be used as evidence, relates to the definition of the thing which has to be established. Basically, the broader and vaguer the approach you adopt to defining the thing which has to be established, the greater and wider the type of information which is likely to be relevant to proving that particular thing. So, for instance, if you look at the third column on the chart, you can see that for making a non-derogating control order, what has to be satisfied in the factual sense is that the person has been involved in terrorism-related activity. And terrorism-related activity is defined in the relevant act as the commission, preparation, or instigation of acts of terrorism, conduct which facilitates the commission, preparation, or instigation of acts of terrorism, conduct which gives encouragement to the commission, preparation, or instigation of acts of terrorism, and D, conduct which gives support or assistance to individuals who are known or believed to be involved in terrorism-related activity. Now, if we consider point D there, that's a very broad thing. Somebody who is also believed to be involved in terrorism-related activity, if I engage in conduct which gives support or assistance to them, then I will engage in terrorism-related activity. If I phone somebody who is believed to be involved in terrorism-related activity, then that is, arguably, capable of being relevant information to determining whether or not I am involved in terrorism-related activity. It may not be sufficient to prove that thing, but it is nonetheless relevant. So the first reason why intelligence is able to be used as evidence in control order proceedings, for instance, is because the definition of the matter which has to be proved is so broad and vague, as it can encompass the sporadic bits and pieces which may arise within the intelligence cycle. However, that might not be enough, because, as Bill said, intelligence is information with a bit of interpretation or with value-added analysis. Often it appears in control order cases that the intelligence is really a collection of bits and pieces of information, none of which on its own really amounts to much. And what the intelligence process involves in terms of analysis is adding a narrative to those pieces of information, so that even though none of them of themselves mean very much, they, when connected in that mutually interdependent way, can achieve a particular level of suspicion about whether or not the individual has engaged in the particular thing which has to be proven. So the second technique is how you define the standard to which the particular thing has to be proven. And if you were to define it, for instance, as beyond reasonable doubt, then intelligence of the sort that I've just described in the narrative, connecting narrative sense, might not be very useful. If you were to describe it, if you were to define the required standard as on the balance of probabilities, if you like, more likely than not, then well, it may or may not meet that standard. But if you were to define it as it is for non-derogated control orders, as you can see in the third column, as merely reasonable suspicion that the person was involved in terrorism-related activity, then you are using what is almost the lowest threshold possible to be met. And in order to illustrate how this works within control order proceedings, I'd like to read you out a hypothetical cross-examination which is based upon reality. I know it's based upon reality because the evidence was given by a special advocate, that is a special government security cleared lawyer, who represents the control person subject to the control order in secret proceedings when secret intelligence evidence is being used as part of the process. So this is a cross-examination, a hypothetical cross-examination, but based upon reality, between a special advocate, that's a security cleared QC, and a witness who is clearly an intelligence person of some sort or other, but isn't identified. So the special advocate says, I can't do a plummy QC's accent, sorry, you can take men out of the bog and all that, but the special advocate says, do you accept that document A, though consistent with sinister with the sinister explanation you attribute to it, is equally consistent with another completely innocent explanation? The witness says, yes. So the sinister explanation is no more than conjecture. The witness says, no. Document A has to be considered alongside documents B, C, D, and E. When viewed as a whole, on a global approach, the sinister explanation is plausible. Special advocate. But you have already admitted that documents B, C, D, and E are in exactly the same category. Each of them is equally consistent with an innocent explanation and with a sinister one. The witness, yes. But when viewed together, they justify the assessment that the sinister explanation is plausible and form the basis of a reasonable suspicion. So it seems to me that that exchange it illustrates the connecting point that I tried to make about tying things together, and also that the claim which was being made by the intelligence witness was not that this means that that person was involved in these matters, but rather was a very legalistic explanation to the effect that it's sufficient for reasonable suspicion. Not beyond reasonable doubt, not even on the balance of probabilities, because two rival sets of explanations were possible. So it seems to me that another way in which intelligence is capable of being evidenced, or is the way in which the system is constructed in order to facilitate intelligence as evidence, is to set the standard to be met in relation to the thing which has to be proved, which is broadly expressed, broadly defined at a very low level. The last set of things was the longest set of things which I was going to discuss, however, briefly, just to say what they were. The last set of things which facilitate the use of intelligence as evidence is to ensure that you construct the process so that the evidence, the intelligence as evidence, cannot be challenged. So if you have secret hearings, now the special advocate is supposed to represent the person who is the controlee in the secret hearing, but the way the British system operates is that once he has seen the secret evidence, he can't speak to the person. okay? Because that would involve revealing the secret information. So if we take our special advocate in the example that I've looked at, there may be, he may have a concrete explanation about document A. The special advocate doesn't know it because he's not allowed to speak to the person who may be able to say, but sorry, on the 19th of February, I was not in the country on the 19th of February. Which would be a direct, well, I don't know what was happening on the 19th of February, but say that that's what was in document A. So there may be a direct concrete contradiction of what document A says. The controlee can never contradict it because he won't be told what it is. And the special advocate cannot represent his interest because he's not allowed to tell the controlee that there is this document A which says you were in the country on the 19th of February. There are all a range of much more complicated points, but they all lead to exactly the same end. So I'll finish up on that.